Thank you, John, and good afternoon to everybody. The Bible contains five books that comprise what the Jews call the festival scroll. And they have chosen festivals throughout the year that they feel have some association with the book. Some of these associations make perfect sense, others perhaps less so. The Book of Esther, they suggest that be read at the time of Purim, which makes sense since the book establishes Purim as a festival to commemorate the deliverance portrayed in the Book of Esther. Ruth is suggested for Pentecost, a wheat harvest festival, and at least some of the book seems to have taken place at that time of the year. Ecclesiastes focuses on the temporariness of our lives. And while we tend to focus more on the millennium at the Feast of Tabernacles, the scriptures make it clear that the theme of Ecclesiastes should also be considered at this feast of temporary dwellings. So we find Ecclesiastes an appropriate book to read at that time. The Song of Solomon gets assigned to the days of unleavened bread. This one is a bit less obvious. Springtime, love, the love of God for his bride. I guess it isn't totally random. But the final book is Lamentations. And it was apparently written by Jeremiah to mourn or lament the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Babylonians. The Jews began memorializing as a fast day, the ninth day of the fifth month, the month of Ab, considered to be the day the temple was destroyed. And that happened in both 586 BC and 70 AD. So it seemed appropriate to them to read Lamentations during their fast to help focus on the reasons for the day. While I don't disagree with that practice, I also observe that we as a church do not tend to keep that fast day. That may be one of the reasons, along with the sobering message, that we don't read Lamentations very much. But I would like to suggest that there is another very appropriate time to focus on this book, because the message of Lamentations fits in very well with the trumpets of warning, plagues, and destruction of the Day of Trumpets, and the sobering reflection of our individual and national separation and need to return to God that we will observe on the Fast of Atonement. So although we do not have the time to read the entire book in this sermon, today I would like to look at the Book of Lamentations and suggest, if you missed reading it on the 9th of Ab, that you consider doing so during this time of year, what the Jews call the Days of Awe, 10 days of repentance and renewal from trumpets to atonement. The book is divided into five chapters. Each chapter has 22 verses, except the third, which has three times that, or 66 verses. You will often hear it said that the chapter and verse numbers are not inspired and were created by translators or other ancient copyists. This cannot be claimed for the Book of Lamentations. These five chapters are five separate poems. Each poem is in a regular meter, lost in most of our translations. I will observe, however, that the New King James Version has an interesting use of capitalized words in the verses that undoubtedly reflects some of the rhythm of the Hebrew language. Also lost in translation is that each poem is an acrostic of the 22-letter Hebrew alphabet, meaning that the first letter of each verse starts with a different letter of the alphabet in order from first to last. So the numbering of chapters and verses is obvious and logical within the text itself. There are three anomalies to this pattern, however. First, the third poem, consisting of 66 verses, has three consecutive verses for each of the Hebrew letters instead of one, hence 66 instead of 22. Second, while the fifth poem does have 22 verses, each containing two short related phrases, the poem is not an acrostic. Only the first four chapters are acrostics. And third, and most mysterious, the second, third, and fourth poems swap the 16th and 17th letters. Now, in researching why, I have discovered that there is growing evidence from archaeology involving ancient writings that the Hebrew alphabet prior to the captivity always had these two letters swapped. And that perhaps it is not these three chapters that are out of order, but rather the first chapter, which may have been corrected by some well-meaning scribe. Evidence for this can even be found in some of the other acrostic passages of Scripture, which I won't go into at this point. Scholars who subscribe to this belief look at this as strong evidence that Lamentations was written just when it seems to have been soon after the destruction of the city around 586 BC and before they adopted the Aramaic order of letters. Now, to lament is to deeply grieve. It is grief almost beyond words. But Jeremiah, inspired by God, gives us some very intense words to describe his grief. While he gave many prophecies in the book that we call Jeremiah, chastising Judah for their sins, such as idolatry and Sabbath breaking, these are absent from Lamentations. The condemnation is gone. While reference is made generally to transgressions and sins, none are enumerated. Instead, Jeremiah assumes the role of one who lived through and suffered the corrective punishment God brought on the city, confesses disobedience, and cries out to God for mercy and help. He expresses extreme compassion and concern for those affected. It's an attitude that many of God's prophets have expressed. Moses literally argued with God to save the lives of the Israelites, even though they deserved to be wiped out. In Ezekiel 9, God sends one clothed in linen to put a mark on those who sigh and cry over the abominations done in Jerusalem. And in verse 8 of that chapter, while this is being done, Ezekiel cries out to God, "O Lord God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel and pouring out your fury on Jerusalem?" And sprinkled throughout his prophecies, Jeremiah expresses these same thoughts. He doesn't want to see everything destroyed and the people killed or taken away. And it's an attitude that we should have as Christians. Pronouncing warning and doom on the nation may be necessary, but we should grieve over that necessity. It's too easy, especially if it doesn't affect us directly, to take the approach, it serves them right. That's what they get for not keeping God's law. Whether it be food laws that they don't keep, perhaps some of the sexual relationship laws that sometimes bring about diseases, or even Sabbath laws that are being broken. The command to cry aloud, "Spare not, lift up your voice as a trumpet," needs to be carried out with compassion, not vengeance. Lamentation starts with a third-person observation of the distress of the city. We'll be spending almost all of our time in the book. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who is great among the nations. The princess among the provinces has become a slave." Now, while this is obviously Jerusalem, as we see in verse 7, we recognize that this lament does not just apply to Jerusalem in 586 when it was written. It happened again in 70 AD with the destruction of the city and temple by the Romans, and it will happen again in our day, as pictured in many of the prophecies we find ourselves contemplating with the various symbols of the trumpet plagues associated with this time of year. And not just for the actual city of Jerusalem, but our own large and capital cities as well. These laments are dual, just as prophecy is dual. In verse 5, we read that her adversaries have become the master, her enemies prosper, for the Eternal has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. So we hear the reason for the punishment, transgressions. In verse 9, her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She has no comforter. O Eternal, behold my affliction, for the enemy is exalted. What was Jerusalem's destiny? She was supposed to be the example city in the whole world, an example of God's way of life. And she will yet be made to fulfill that role. She also didn't consider what her destiny would be if she refused to obey God. With verse 12, we begin a first-person address to the reader about the situation, seemingly from the city itself. It starts up in verse 12. It says, "Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Behold and see if there's any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Eternal has inflicted in the day of his fierce anger." In verse 18, "The Eternal is righteous, for I rebelled against his commandment. Hear now, all peoples, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity." So Jerusalem here is admitting their guilt. Verse 19, "I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders breathed their last in the city while they sought food to restore their life." And now the city addresses God directly in verse 20 and says, "See, O Eternal, that I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. Outside the sword bereaves, at home it is like death." Verse 21, "They have heard that I sigh, but no one comforts me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. Bring on the day you have announced, that they may become like me." Well, what is this day that was announced? Assuming Jeremiah was the author, he made it pretty clear in his book. Turn to Jeremiah 25. This is one of the few times that we'll be leaving Lamentations, so you might make sure you have an easy way to get back. Jeremiah 25 is an entire chapter dealing with this subject. I'll just read a few verses from it, beginning in verse 11. Jeremiah 25, "And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, says the Eternal, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it perpetual desolations. And I will bring upon that land all my words which I have pronounced against it, even all that is written in this book which Jeremiah has prophesied against all the nations." In verse 29, "For behold, I begin to bring calamity on the city which is called by my name. And should you be utterly unpunished," talking to these other nations, including Babylon, "you shall not be unpunished, for I will call for a sword on all the inhabitants of the earth, says the Eternal of hosts." The entire chapter is quite interesting, listing all the nations of the world at that time and the punishment that they will receive. It's not just Israel that's being dealt with. And we think in terms of this, of the day of the Lord at the end of time, when the same thing will happen. Israel will be punished perhaps in the time of Jacob's trouble, and then the day of the Lord where God intervenes and punishes the whole world before the return of Jesus Christ. Back to Lamentations. The chapter concludes in verse 22 by saying, "Let their wickedness come before you, and do to them as you have done to me for all my transgressions, for my sighs are many, and my heart is faint." And so we see here Jeremiah expressing the same things that he had been asked to prophesy, and that these would come to pass. The second poem begins with a description of God's anger and the punishment he unleashed on the city. destroying their houses, palaces, strongholds of protection, and even their place of worship, the temple. Starts out in verse 1, how the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. Footstool would have been the ark and the temple. He destroyed that as well. The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied all the dwelling places of Jacob. He has thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger. And it goes on, each verse describing something about the fury of God or the indignation that he's expressing as he destroys the strongholds of the nation as well as his temple. Did you go on this way until verse 9? And with verse 10, we begin another lament for the people of the city. I'm going to go right down to verse 13, however. Because in verse 13, we see a compassionate desire to comfort the people. And I think as much as any place, this is where we should note that Jeremiah is not the real author of Lamentations. Lamentations can be seen as a cry from God himself. And verse 13 says, how shall I console you? To what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you, that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is spread wide as the sea. Who can heal you? It reminds us of some of the thoughts that Jesus had when he was here on the earth. I don't want to bother turning to all of them, but there are three of them that show up in the book of Luke. And I'll just read them, I'm sure you're familiar with them. In Luke 13:34, Jesus said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, which kill the prophets and stone them that are sent unto you. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen does gather her brood under her wings, and you would not. In 1941 of the book of Luke, now as he drew near, this is drawing near to the city of Jerusalem during the triumphal entry, he saw the city and he wept over it, saying, if you had known, even you, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. And even when he was walking to Golgotha, having been beaten, and the women see what's happened to him and they're weeping, Jesus says in chapter 23, verse 28, he turns to them and says, daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children, because he knew how bad things were going to get for all of them. Let's move now to the third poem. It is the center of the book. It's in a different format, as I mentioned, and it has quite a different sentiment. It is a poem filled with hope and a different focus. First, we read of the personal suffering of the author, probably Jeremiah. He starts out by saying, I am the man who has been seen affliction by the rod of his wrath. He has led me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. Surely he has turned his hand against me, time and time again throughout the day. We'll note that he says, God has turned his hand against him. And I think as we see throughout the scriptures and especially and even in the Lamentations, God has not turned his heart against the people. In verse 14, I have become the ridicule of all my people, their taunting song all the day. Jeremiah was personally ridiculed and taunted, and we may find at times that we are as well. Verse 17, you have moved my soul far from peace. I have forgotten prosperity. And I said, my strength and my hope have perished from the eternal. But as we read verse 19, we can see the beginnings of a change in thinking. Instead of complaining, he asks God to remember. He says, remember my affliction and roaming, the wormwood and the gall. He continues in verse 20 about what he remembers. My soul still remembers and sinks within me, he says. And finally in verse 21, this I recall to my mind. Therefore, I have hope. And what follows seems to be a list of what he has finally remembered about God. Things we should remember too, not just the punishment, but the mercy. Verse 22, though the Lord's mercies are not consumed, because through the Eternal's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. In verse 22, they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Of course, we just sang that song, which is taken from, in part, from the Book of Lamentations. It also has a line, as it says in verse 24, the Eternal is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I hope in him. The poem continues, the Eternal is good to those who wait for him, to the soul who seeks him. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Eternal. There's much hope in this passage. It is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. We might ask, what is this yoke? Possibly what is referred to are the next three verses. Let him sit alone and keep silent, because God has laid it on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust, there may yet be hope. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes him and be full of reproach. In other words, there may be times when God has brought on a trial, or we have to turn the other cheek, as Christ said, or we may find ourselves with our mouth in the dust. But God will rescue us. And it says in verse 31, the Lord will not cast off forever. Verse 32, though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he does not afflict willingly nor grieve the children of men. Then in verse 34, it says, to crush under one's feet all the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the justice due a man before the face of the Most High, or subvert a man in his cause, the Lord does not approve. So these are things that God does not approve of, and he will rescue us from them as a result of that. And so, since God is this way, what should we do about all this? Well, in verse 37, it says, who is he who speaks and it comes to pass when the Lord has not commanded it? The Babylonians did not destroy Jerusalem because that was their desire. It was because God desired it to be done. Otherwise, they would not have succeeded. Verse 38, is it not from the mouth of the Most High that woe and well-being proceed? God is in charge. All happens according to his will. Why should a living man complain? A man for the punishment of his sins. We need to remember that we are men, we're not angels, and we're subject to what men suffer. We also need to remember that we are still alive, we are living men. And even though we may suffer from some trial or punishment for what we brought on ourselves, we should just quit complaining. We did it to ourselves. Verse 40, let us search out and examine our ways, turn back to the Eternal. Reminiscent of these examining yourself before Passover. But also, examining ourselves before the Day of Atonement. We're not fasting just to go hungry. We need to be looking at our lives and what we've been doing or not doing that needs to change. Verse 41, let us lift our hearts and hands to God in heaven. Verse 42 to 54 is an admission of guilt and complaint over his punishment. It's a return to some of the despair in some sense. But then in verse 55, we come back to the hope. Hope in God. I called on your name, O Eternal, from the lowest pit. You have heard my voice. Do not hide your ear from my sighing, from my cry for help. We know that God does hear our pleas. And in verse 57, you drew near on the day I called on you and said, do not fear. He hears our plea, but he also comforts us. O Lord, you have pleaded the case for my soul. You have redeemed my life. What follows is a powerful, imprecatory prayer for the persecutors. Remember a few weeks ago hearing that sermon about imprecatory prayer, that which occasionally shows up in the scriptures where a prayer is given to bring on the day you've announced, as it says in chapter 121 that we looked at earlier, that God would go ahead and punish those people that have been wronging his people and doing things that are not in God's desire. So in verse 59, it says, O Eternal, you have seen how I am wronged. Judge my case. You have seen all their vengeance, all their schemes against me. And it goes on to, describing this desire for God to intervene. In verse 66, it says, in your anger, pursue and destroy them from under the heavens of the Eternal. We move on to the fourth poem. It starts as another reflection on their miseries. And it pretty much goes on that way for the first 20 verses, I would say. Till you get to verse 21, and we get another sort of imprecatory prayer, you might say. It says, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, you who dwell in the land of Uz. Edom was very glad that Israel had been destroyed. He says, rejoice and be glad. But then it says, this cup shall also pass over you, and you shall become drunk and make yourself naked. In other words, sure, rejoice now, but you're next. Then it continues in verse 22. The punishment of your iniquity is accomplished, O daughter of Zion. He will no longer send you into captivity. He will punish your iniquity, O daughter of Edom. He will uncover your sins. There are many other passages that describe specifically Edom being destroyed. In the book of Jeremiah, chapter 49, for example, the entire book of Obadiah deals with the subject of Edom being destroyed. And we find that also in the book of Psalms. God is not happy with how they've been acting and how they've been treating. And he doesn't, even though he uses some of these nations to punish Israel, he doesn't let them get away with it. The fifth poem, as I said, is not an acrostic. It is very poetic. Each verse consists of two short little sub-verses, ideas that are related and go together. But it starts out as a recapitulation of the sufferings. However, this recapitulation is being addressed to God. It's sometimes called the prayer of Jeremiah We have a prayer in the book of Daniel, for example, and many of these prophets prayed to God to express their desires and feelings. And it starts out, it says, "Remember, O Eternal, what has come upon us. Look and behold our reproach. Our inheritance has been turned over to aliens and our houses to foreigners." It's kind of a horrifying thought to contemplate that something like that could happen, that somebody could come in and our houses could be turned over to foreigners. People in the Ukraine are probably experiencing that now. Hopefully we won't have to do that anytime soon, but that's not what the prophecies seem to indicate. In verse 19, we get a final earnest prayer from Jeremiah. "You, O Eternal, remain forever, your throne from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever and forsake us for so long a time? Turn us back to you, O Eternal, and we will be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are very angry with us." That last verse almost seems like an odd way to end the book. It seems like a very negative way, doesn't it? And yet, what have we read prior to this? We've read about God's promises. We've read that he has not forsaken his people, and he will bring them back. It might be better to look at this, I realize it's adding some words to it, but it's more like it says, unless, contrary to what you have promised, you really have utterly rejected us. Book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 7, verse 2 says, "It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better." This time of year, prior to the joyous celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, we are reminded also of the joyous times ahead when Christ returns and we are resurrected at the last trump and the Satan is put away, and allowing peace to reign on the earth. But also this time of year, we picture some of the more sobering aspects of trumpets and the Day of Atonement. And so maybe instead of just focusing on the feast of rejoicing, we should also think about the house of mourning. Lamentations is a book that can help us focus on our need to sigh and cry over what is happening to this world and cry out to God for his loving mercy and and compassion. "Turn us back to you, O Lord, and we will be restored, unless, contrary to what you've promised, you really have utterly rejected us."